Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Listeners may recall that the state of Oregon passed an initiative in 2014 that legalized the adult social use of marijuana and led the state to develop a legal regulatory system for marijuana cultivation and distribution. Many people thought that as a result of those votes, prohibition was finally on the way out. The problem is, that's not really what happened. Here in the United States, we've been prohibiting some controlled substances for more than a century now. Those policies weren't going to change overnight just because a few states have made it legal for adults to obtain and possess marijuana for their own use. Not even in those legal states. Some drug policy reform activists have even started calling this new era of marijuana regulation Prohibition 2.0. Today, I'm pleased to welcome our guest, Dr. Dominic Korva. Dominic is the founder and executive director of the Center for the Study of Cannabis and Social Policy, located in Seattle, Washington. He's a political geographer and public policy scholar. He'll be in Portland on September 27th, speaking on the topic of popular anxieties, controlling cannabis and other markets at the end of the world. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, I'll be asking Dominic about that and a lot more. So, before any ado can possibly be furthered, let's get started. Dominic, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing fabulous. It's a beautiful Seattle day here in the Pacific Northwest.
So, first things first, could you tell folks a little bit about the Center for the Study of Cannabis and Social Policy, CASP for short, yeah?
So, the Center for the Study of Cannabis and Social Policy is a research and education nonprofit. With the central mission of really removing the drug war from cannabis legalization and educating people about how to do that, perhaps. So that's going to be definitely what I'll be talking about in Portland on September 27th as well.
The legal regulation of marijuana by states, is it, as some people have been saying, is it actually a Prohibition 2.0?
Basically, I think that that's a useful way to describe it, although the way I've been kind of describing it lately is a term called post-prohibition, and it's really what it is legalization with prohibition, not after prohibition. And so it really is, the prefix post is often used in academia where I come from to, like, postmodern, right? Postmodern actually doesn't mean after modernity, but actually, like, with modernity, multiple modernities, complex modernities. So it's kind of borrowed from a jargon trick, I suppose, that is pretty common in the social sciences. But it's really meant to kind of clearly describe that, yes, we have, essentially an economic or political economic form of legalization that's going on. And I say politically economic because really the state and the market have everything to do with each other. And that's especially clear, I think, with cannabis legalization. But what we don't have here is the legalization of, I think, a culture, right? To the extent that the drug war prohibition is a cultural institution, right? Part of the, goes out of the culture wars, racial justice issues and so forth, that, just simply creating a political economy for cannabis doesn't really address the entirety and source of the drug war itself, right, which is ultimately an ongoing sort of culture war. And when I say it's a cultural institution, I mean that it's, a cultural institution that has been getting along with all the other cultural institutions in a certain way for quite some time. So it's, part of what's going on. So Prohibition 2.0, I think, is a useful way to think about it as well. It helps us think about kind of an updated, upgraded version of Prohibition. I just think that we got to try to think about this as, like, it's people that are being prohibited, not just the substance. And that's why I prefer kind of this cultural definition of Prohibition.
There are a lot of other aspects. I mean, employment, you can still be caught with cannabis in your system and denied employment. The Child Protective Services may decide that marijuana use is sufficient reason to yank someone away from their parents. You've got any number of ways in which if marijuana shows up on your screen when it's possible a pain contract might be the pain prescription might be stopped. Yeah. I mean,
and your prior cannabis convictions are still living with you for things that are legal now.
I'm very curious about the thing that you're doing on the 27th at the Commune PDX. Popular Anxieties Controlling Cannabis and Other Markets at the End of the World. That is one heck of a catchy title, man. What? Unpack that. What's this about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I've been thinking a lot, and definitely inspired by Bruce Alexander's work in particular, about, the anxieties that people with prohibition culture have. Like, what are anxieties particular to that culture? And, a lot of their anxieties kind of center around, the specter of addiction, really. And they apply that kind of logic as something they fear for cannabis still, even though that wasn't why cannabis was prohibited in the first place at all. They maintain that fear and that anxiety. And so I've been thinking about that as kind of the culture war that needs to be fought, the front that needs to be fought to deal with exactly those things you just described. They're still here because people are afraid of essentially, the plant as a drug in terms of drug addiction. And until we can change that cultural meaning for them, we're going to be stuck with this stuff. The ongoing Prohibition 2.0. And so I've tried to think, and I think a kinder way about it a little bit, to take seriously that many people are real anxieties, even if they're not grounded in evidence. And I think about, what do we know, how are we resilient with our anxieties, and culture, what's our repertoire for dealing with anxieties? And so this actually is pretty fun because it actually brings us back to cannabis in a certain way, because for cannabis culture, that's certainly one of the ways in which cannabis is mindfully used is to deal with anxiety of all sorts. It's the number one self-reported, reason why they use cannabis in self-sex in this groundbreaking study. And then I think about, outside of cannabis culture and the rest of the society, what do they have? And what they have is, SSRIs. They have pharmaceutical drugs in particular that are the recommended things to deal with their anxieties. And I think that at this point, after, 30, 40 years of more and more SSRI prescriptions and rampant dependence upon these drugs, we have actually more mental illness than we had before these things even started. And I think people are kind of getting hip to that. They're getting wise to it. I think they're beginning to realize that there's something really weird about this situation, that Americans use more drugs to deal with anxiety and depression than anybody in the world, and yet we have worse and worse situation with respect to mental health. And of course, like, from my perspective as someone within cannabis culture, it's because our society is sick. And it's making them sick, and the ways in which actually the pharmaceutical industry is part of the reproduction, mental sickness is a bit of a problem. And so I think that's part of the culture wars, I think, kind of teaching those people who are anxious about, daily users as drug addicts or as problem users, that actually what we're doing is an alternative to the things that haven't been working in society. And so, that's how I want to kind of frame the other, that popular anxiety about, you know, cannabis and addiction as an opportunity, an educational opportunity, a cultural war, really, a battle to be fought, is really like to help people understand the things that might be making them sick and that the choices that they have under, you know, conditions of generalized crisis, economic and what have you, that maybe there's, you know, a different way to use cannabis and a different relationship people have with the plant that is therapeutic. And that, that is, you know, not something that they should continue to be stigmatized and punished for and have convictions on their records. They have to actually go spend money on a lawyer to go get, you know, expunged or vacated, depending on what state you're in, what the terminology is. So the talk is kind of just attempt to kind of connect and trace the, you know, the connection between prohibition as a cultural institution with our political economy, our dominant political economy, you know, characterized essentially by a state that's so starved for cash that it's just got a grab for you know, sin taxes, basically, instead of being, you know, progressive income taxes in the United States. You know, with a market situation that is just not good for small business, that favors corporate businesses, then of course, that's where the cannabis is going to go, because that's our political economy. So I'm going to be tracing those connections between what we had before and what's changing, and really try to get at that, the cultural, you know, source of the anxieties and the particular markets and policies that we get.
Interesting. And I can see where this is going to be. I mean, the one thing about marketing, people, anxieties are how we market things. You know, we developed the concept of bad breath and all, and body, B.O., and all that kind of stuff by making people, you know, anxious and concerned and self-conscious. And
exactly,
so we
right.
market things to them. And it's, well, it's interesting. I mean, you're talking about the SSRIs, and of course, marijuana is often used by people to substitute for not just painkillers, but also things like the antidepressants and the tranquilizers and any other ones. Many of those pharmaceutical drugs are also implicated in the overdose crisis that we've been experiencing. I mean, it's not only opioids that people are using, and oftentimes in combination, we're getting all these other, and the risk of overdose, it increases when you combine these drugs. I mean, people don't get told about this, but that's, you know, they should be getting told a lot more clearly, or at least maybe they just need to listen better. I don't know. But,
I think that you're getting at something very important when you bring up advertising, because, you know, the root of a market society is really, you know, the addiction to consume things and to consume them mindlessly and based upon essentially advertising rather than any particular use value. And I think that that's the core, you know, thing at this point that can change our society at large is actually doing what, you know, is happening, you know, with, you know, fair trade, you know, commodities and so forth, which is, you know, people actually consuming more mindfully, choosing things based on, you know, a sense that they're connected to an ecology of life rather than totally separate from it, and not caring what kind of system gave you that product. And I think that, you know, under conditions of generalized financialization, financial capitalism, what you have to do is you have to starve the beast, and you starve the beast by not giving into marketing. You starve the beast by not being drawn in by advertising. You starve the beast by actually, you know, kind of refusing to simply consume from a menu that's been presented to you. And I think that that's the work to do. It's interesting when it comes to like marketing and advertising around cannabis today. Is that's the difference now as well, is that what was, you know, the way, how was cannabis advertised before, besides, say, movies or music, which, of course, will always be advertising drug use. And I think that the answer is really your peers, your friends, historically, in terms of, like, you know, how people came to cannabis. There's a story to it that's a social one. And what we're placing is that way in which cannabis got to the people that ultimately could find it useful with a system that is, you know, branding, advertising, marketing. There's nothing really social to it. It's purely spectacular, you know, in the Boyd sense.
This is, well, this is, you're reminding me of a friend was posting not long ago about concerns about the commodification, commoditization. How do you want to say it, of the counterculture? You know, it's being packaged and sold, and I mean that's been going on for many years. It's not just marijuana, but is that? It would seem that in a sense. Marijuana would work against the cannabis culture would work against that commodification, but it seems to be happening. Am I getting all mixed up? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I think that it's important, you know, not to be totalitarian, and to acknowledge that, you know, culture is something that's produced by people, independent of, you know, other people governing them necessarily. And so, also, people are complex culturally. You know, I mean. You know, there's a huge percentage of medical doctors that are also, you know, deeply religious people. And their sort of science beliefs and their religious beliefs, you know, go out quite, you know, quite easily within them. And so, yeah, you know, definitely. Consumerism and commodification have been a part of cannabis culture since the 1960s, there's no question. And it's been amplified by the ways in which, you know, the hippie ideas got out and became, you know, corporate and big, you know, you know, your Whole Foods and so forth. And really, like, I think the entire category of, you know, corporate social responsibility, right? I mean, if you'll recall, you know, two fairly famous yippies, you know, Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, ultimately, Jerry Rubin became a Wall Street stockbroker and, you know, toured college campuses in the 80s. You know, debating Abby Hoffman over, you know, yippies versus yuppies, you know. Jerry Rubin said, greed is good, you know. I mean, there was definitely, you know, an element of, you know, marketing, I think, of hippie culture as hippie culture from the very beginning. But I think that what I'm referring to is more of something that kind of developed in the U.S. after that, you know, in terms of cannabis culture. And it was, I think it was a set of practices and people who related to cannabis as more than a commodity. And that wasn't everybody. You know, I think it's plenty of people, I think as the market is showing you right now, just buy cannabis for, you know, THC percentage and price, right? And so there are class aspects to that and so forth. But I think the moment you start kind of, you know, having a relationship with the plant is more than about, you know, what you paid for it. Like, you're at that point creating cannabis culture. It's just sort of reproducing a commodity relationship, a simple economic exchange.
You know, down here in Oregon, when we had, you know, our rules, our regulations, the social clubs, the sort of, you know, what you might have like a bar kind of thing, we don't have here. There is an effort that's starting up now to convince the legislature to allow for these social use kind of, you know, adult social use places. I mean, just a place where, like I say, my apartment complex, it would be a violation of my lease to use marijuana, and three of those violations could get me evicted. So for me, it's a little problematic. And having a place where I could go that was just around the corner, or maybe even a mile or so away, where I could relax would, you know. Now, in terms of the culture, how do you think that that a social club might help in terms of the or might affect rather the cannabis culture, as it were?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, like, I think it's I mean, what do you think of when you think about the cannabis social club? You know, you think about Dennis Pallone, and you know, you think about the place that was essentially for people with HIV and AIDS to come together and be in a room where, you know, no one was, like, stigmatizing them, basically, and saying that they deserve to die, and brutalizing them, you know, for being sick and also having cannabis. And they could be in a space where they, you know, could consume with each other. And in many ways, like, it was that social aspect that was the most therapeutic part of it. And the cannabis was there to kind of like mix the crowds, you know. It was people with HIV and AIDS in particular, and they were the core part of that scene. But then also there was a diverse group of people that eventually came in and also mingled with them. And so there's a really important kind of communitarian, you know, need for social spaces, as well as the individual need, given, you know, conditions of prohibition 2.0, where, you know, you literally have to own your own place to be, you know, legally safe consuming inside of it. And that's a class issue, right? You know, like only people with enough money to buy houses get to have a safe space to access. So I think that social clubs are, you know, it's one of those things that the main thing that they're coming up with, come against really in Washington State, though, is less the attitude that there shouldn't be social clubs. More, it's the smoking regulations that have come online in the last 20 years, the zoning. And I don't know if that's the case in Oregon as well. Of course, you know, people use those zoning ordinances for, you know, reasons other than simply not liking smoking. But that's a tough one, because now you're dealing with not just the stigma against cannabis users, but the stigma against the act of smoking, right, or even vaporizing. There are plenty of places that, you know, bans on that, and I think it's the Clean Air Act, actually, in Washington State, that makes it impossible. That's the one thing that they have to solve in order to be able to make that happen. I don't know if that's the case in Oregon, but I suspect it might also be.
We're getting up towards the end of the show. Again, folks, we are talking with Dr. Dominic Korva. He's founder and executive director of the Center for the... Founder and executive director of the Center for the Study of Cannabis and Social Policy, located up in Seattle, Washington. He's going to be coming to Portland on September 27th to speak on the topic of popular anxieties, controlling cannabis and other markets at the end of the world. And that's going to be at the Commune PDX. Dominic, any closing thoughts for the listeners? And what's the URL for your the cannabis and stuff, for CASP, the CASP website, and your social media stuff too?
It's www.cannabisandsocialpolicy.org. And we're not really active on Twitter, but we have a pretty active Facebook page. But the final thoughts are, you know, I think especially for a Prison Pipeline show that I want to talk about is that the invisible punishments that people face, you know, even after they get out of jail. That's something that there's some concrete action that's happening right now on the West Coast and elsewhere, which is, you know, I think led by California's example, at least in the initiative of having a expungement rod that was required. Well, now in California, they've got further, you know, try to make that easier on people, because just simply like allowing or saying it's going to happen doesn't have like a fiscal note with it. It doesn't make the jurisdiction actually, you know, make it easy on people to access that right that the initiative is giving them. And so up here in Washington State, we've had, Spokane too. Spokane successfully passed one of those 2 years back. City of Seattle is trying to do something, and it's going through the judicial branch. Currently, it's not a slam dunk that will happen, but it was supposed to automatically vacate convictions. And we're doing work right now, CASP, and especially our capacity of working with the Cannabis Alliance in Seattle, Washington. We are partnering with a bunch of people to try to get a legislative vehicle for the spring that will set us down the same path that California has. And there's going to be different aspects to it, but making the process easier as well as simply getting a law, those are kind of two things we have to think about at the same time. And there are a bunch of other states that are talking about it. So I think this is one of the kind of next really, you know, achievable battles with criminal justice reform and cannabis post-prohibition. Is achieving these kinds of ways for people after prison to clear their records and be able to access jobs easier. And so I think it's an important project that we're working on. And I encourage people to pay attention and get involved in their own state to do it.
Dominic, I thank you so much for your time today. It is such a pleasure to talk to you, man, and I'm so glad you're doing the work that you are. Again, Dr. Dominic Korva, founder and executive director of the Center for the Study of Cannabis and Social Policy, on the web at cannabisandsocialpolicy.org. Well, that was my conversation with Dominic Korva, PhD, founder and executive director of the Center for the Study of Cannabis and Social Policy up in Seattle, Washington. Again, Dominic will be speaking in Portland, Oregon on September 27th on the topic of popular anxieties, controlling cannabis and other markets at the end of the world. And for now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you have been listening to Prison Pipeline. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline at the website kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Many thanks to my guest, Dominic Korva. A heartfelt thank you to our engineers, Danielle Parks and Mike Vitaklis. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing. Some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard.